I'm going to talk about some of the kinds of human subjects issues that I've been dealing with for the last almost 9 years now as Associate Director for Clinical Research. When you have an application that goes through the peer review process, as was described yesterday, if you have questions raised by the peer reviewers concerning the human subject protections or the safeguards, the monitoring, et cetera, that you have proposed for a study, including a career development award, then there may be a restriction or a bar even on funding an application. All of those applications that have human subject concerns will come to this office for review, regardless of which division they are sent to in the institute. That happens after the peer review process, before the funding is actually taking place, because you cannot get funded until you get this human subjects bar lifted. So I will meet some of you in that context. That's not a bad thing. Most of the human subject concerns that come up are along the lines of, we really couldn't tell exactly what the protections were or who exactly is going to be in the study and who would be excluded. Could you clarify that? Could you clarify your data monitoring plan, et cetera? So don't be overly concerned if you wind up having to deal with me in the context of my other job. Most of your colleagues have already done that, and they're still around, and their research got funded. I can think of very, very few studies that actually did not get funded based on human subject concerns. Usually they are just things that need to be resolved and clarified. Now, for this morning, I'm going to highlight some of the current controversies in human subjects research. I'm going to mention some that are particular relevance to research on children and adolescents. And I'm going to highlight some of the issues that I think you're going to be hearing more about in the next couple of years. So let's see how this works. Oh, very good. These are the general subjects that I'm going to cover, I hope briefly, so we can have some time for discussion and questions and answers. The three words that you see there, autonomy, beneficence, and justice, I'm not going to get into defining, or I would run out of time quickly. That's the principle of the individual's authority to make decision. Beneficence refers to the general preponderance of benefit over risk, including benefit to society. And justice regards the risks and the benefits of research and the extent to which they are fairly distributed among different groups. A particular group should not be expected to bear all the risk of research if that group is unlikely to achieve any of the potential benefits of that. Now, I just mentioned the word potential, but I'm going to have to correct that in a short time, because the issue is really foreseeable risk versus anticipated benefits. The criteria for risks and benefits are commonly referred to as risks and benefits or potential risks and benefits, and the assumption that many people have is that we use the same criteria. But that is explicitly not true, and it's always been explicitly not true as long as we've had the Belmont Report and the Common Rule. We are responsible for letting people know about foreseeable risk, those within the range for which predictions are possible. However, you would not hold out as an anticipated benefit something that might happen but probably won't happen. In other words, some people in a phase one study may actually show clinical improvement. Do we really expect that to happen? No. So we don't promise things that we don't think are really likely to happen in the benefits category. However, there are risks that are actually relatively unlikely to occur, but we do include those in the consent documents. So be aware, when we're talking about risks and benefits, we're not trying to balance the scale. We're trying to make sure that the risks are minimized and that the benefit to risk ratio is as favorable as possible. Let's see. I also wanted to mention the issue of appropriate alternative courses. we get so carried away with the risk-benefit analysis that we forget when you're doing a treatment study, an equally important consideration has to do with what are the alternatives. Does the person have to be in this trial to get the treatment that they are being offered? Can they get the same treatment from a practitioner on the outside? Because if that's true, you need to tell the subjects that when they're considering whether to be in the study. Otherwise, it could be coercive. They could feel the only way I can get this study, this study medication, is to be in this study and to take the risk involved. And if that's not true, you need to make sure that people realize that clearly. Safeguards and monitoring, I'm going to get to that very shortly. Now, I mentioned benefits. There are benefits to the individual subjects, which we refer to as direct benefits. These typically only are going to be seen in a treatment trial. We also have, and I think this is an underrated area, the likelihood of scientific progress, the benefit to society of carrying out that particular research study. In most cases, there's not going to be the prospect of direct benefit to the subject unless you're doing clinical trials research. However, there, we certainly hope, is considerable likelihood that there will be scientific progress, and that progress will be important, we hope, to the clinical disorder under study. So there are some problems involved with this. For instance, I think the child regs, which tend to emphasize benefits to subjects in the four categories of permissible research, in some cases benefits to society are not considered relevant. There are categories of research, for instance, greater than minimal risk, but with the prospect of direct benefit. There is also a category of risk that is described as a minor increase over minimal risk, but relevant to the clinical condition under study. So these categories of risk for children differ from those in adult. And in particular, in children, it is more difficult to justify exposure to higher risk without the prospect of direct benefit to the child. One of the problems with that is that it tends to favor drug studies in some cases. Clinical testing of the fifth drug in a category, another Me Too drug, is likely to be favored by these review criteria because there is the prospect of direct benefit from this new medication. Whereas a study that's looking at the underlying etiology or pathophysiology, as you saw in the slides yesterday, which is the direction in which we are trying to move, are relatively disadvantaged in these discussions. So be aware that there are categories of research for children that may make it more difficult to justify conducting the study without the prospect of direct benefit. And unfortunately, sometimes that leads people to combine treatment trials with somewhat more risky underlying pathophysiology studies, what's sometimes referred to as bundling. That can be a big problem. I'll get to that in just a second. I'm going to skip relatively briefly through this. These are the types of research designs that raise ethical questions, sometimes in IRBs, sometimes in the study sections that will review your applications. And they are one of the reasons that they may show up on my desk, because we at the NIMH typically pay a little more attention to the kinds of study designs that may actually be likely to worsen the clinical condition of the participants. In some cases, there is a delay in the onset of effective treatment in order to be in the study. Obviously, that's not uncommon, and if it's not too long, and if the clinical condition under study is not particularly dangerous to follow without treatment, then that can typically be justified. But it needs to be made very clear exactly what the kinds of protections will be if there is going to be a delay in treatment, or even more difficult, the discontinuation of an effective treatment that a child is receiving. Again, you can do these designs, but you need to be much more careful in focusing on how you will prevent a child from deteriorating clinically? What are the rescue strategies? What if the child, will you know if the child begins to deteriorate? Will the, with the warning, will the warnings be clear in the consent so that the parents know who to call? Will you have provisions in mind for potentially emergency hospitalization, reinstitutionalization of treatment, et cetera? We don't see symptom challenge designs where a medication or compound is given that, or a psychological exposure that is likely to worsen a person's clinical condition, but we do still see some of those used. Another concern is the prospect of limited debriefing and limited availability of the treatment after the study. Again, this is particularly relevant for research involving children. If we say that the research in many categories has to have the prospect of direct benefit, but the child is only going to get the acute treatment trial for 8 weeks, and if after that 8 weeks, the child and the parents are going to be told, well, we're not going to break the blind on this study for another year, so we can't tell you which treatment you got, and there are no provisions to make that treatment available to you after the acute trial, some IRBs will say, well, is that the prospect of direct benefit? If you're only presenting the prospect of direct benefit for 8 weeks, then you need to make that clear in the consent document that you're not promising anything more. There is a much greater tendency nowadays to have evaluators who are blind to the treatment assignment and people who are clinically involved and not blind, who can debrief the parents and the child after a trial, who can make plans for referral, or for making sure that an effective treatment is actually made available, or if the child had intolerable side effects on a particular drug, it would be nice for the child and parents and clinician to know that so the child doesn't get put right back on that drug when they're referred back to the community. So these are some of the considerations that that frequently come up. I'm just going to skip through this for the sake of time here. Some of the consent elements. Obviously, the purpose of the study, although you would be amazed how often this is described in the most vague possible terms, it's useful to tell people why they are being selected to be in this study. Because if the person doesn't think they have this disorder and they have these symptoms and they're in this treatment, then you probably don't want them in the study, because it's going to be hard to say that they are giving informed consent if they don't even believe they have the disorder under study. I mentioned risks, benefits, and alternatives and the issue of bundling. There are studies in which you might need to do certain biological measures and to do those in the context of a treatment trial. Usually that's not the case. For instance, here in the intramural program, if there is a spinal tap or some underlying neurochemical study that is done, in the context of a treatment trial, there is typically a separate consent document and consent process for higher risk procedures like spinal taps, because the participant needs to know, do I have to get this spinal tap to get access to this experimental treatment? Do I have to do all of these other things in order to get access to this drug or this psychotherapy that may produce direct benefit? If you are going to combine these non-therapeutic measures with treatment trials, you need to be very careful to make sure that they are made clear in the consent and that it's clear to subjects whether they can participate in some parts of the study without being in the whole study. And believe me, your IRB will want to know the answers to those questions. I'm going to mention safeguards and monitoring in just a minute, but you know, obviously the consent needs to describe the foreseeable risks, who you should call if you begin to see certain clinical problems. So let me move on to the data and safety monitoring issue. This applies specifically to interventions. It can most often be heard in the context of a clinical trial, and this can involve all phases of clinical trials, even relatively early stages, not just phase three. Data and safety monitoring is required by the NIH, and you must have a data and safety monitoring plan in an application that includes an intervention, that includes a treatment trial. That applies regardless of whether it's a drug study for psychosocial intervention or combined treatments. The plan will typically describe recruitment, retention, and how the study integrity will be maintained, both in terms of keeping the data safe and having internal checks as needed, but also, and more importantly, the reporting of unanticipated problems or adverse events that occur during the study. If a child becomes psychotic unexpectedly during the course of a trial, who needs to know about that? I mean, if it's an unanticipated problem involving risk to subjects or others, that by definition has to be reported to the local IRB. However, there are situations where that also has to be reported to some other people. That's what I'm going to touch on shortly. Finally, what are the stopping rules? If one sees a preponderance, for instance, of adverse events of a particular type in people who are in treatment group A compared to treatment group B, would you notice that that was happening? Who would be looking at that? Would there be some unbiased way to assess whether there is a higher risk in one treatment group than another? And if there is a higher risk in one group than another, is it balanced by a higher treatment efficacy within that group? Typically, the data monitoring groups will look at those sorts of questions so they don't expose another 50 subjects to a higher risk without any real likelihood of benefit, when they could have known earlier that this study was unlikely to show any difference, and yet to continue to expose children to the higher risks in a particular study arm. These are the kind of things that the boards will look at. Now, NIH has indeed said all clinical trials require some form of monitoring, and the monitoring should be commensurate with the risks and with the size and complexity of the study. So you want to make sure that you have the appropriate expertise in the room or around the conference phone. You would like as much as possible for the people who are doing the monitoring to be independent. People who are named as key personnel on the grant and receive salary through a grant are probably not the best members of your independent data monitoring board. However, if you are doing, for instance, a very small pilot study, then it may be unrealistic to have six outside experts who are completely independent of the study. That's why we keep coming back to the word commensurate with the risk and complexity of the study. Again, obviously, confidentiality needs to be maintained, not just because clinically sensitive data are being looked at, but because the blind of the study can easily be damaged during the course of monitoring if it's not thought out in advance. So, small, low-risk, single-site study, the PI could probably perform that function. You don't have to propose a board. You don't have to propose an independent committee. But you have to bear in mind that the greater the risk and the greater the complexity of the study, the more sites are involved, the more likely you're going to need to propose something independent. For phase three trials, the NIH requires an independent data and safety monitoring board. Unfortunately, NIH has not yet clearly defined exactly what's the difference between a data and safety monitoring board and a plan. So I think you're going to hear more about that in the next year or so. I'm going to just skip through this. The IRBs are clearly responsible for reviewing the ongoing safety of a study, and they do that at intervals of 1 year at the at least once a year they have to refer to review the progress of the study and the safety issues, and unanticipated problems need to be reported to the IRB, and if they are related to the study, they need to be reported to OHRP and to us, the funders. We want to hear if a study is stopped by the local IRB because there is a safety issue in the trial, or if the study is modified based on a safety issue in the trial, because we need to consider whether you're actually going to be able to continue to do the study under the changed circumstances. So the local IRB looks at these data as they accumulate. They receive these reports of any problems with human subjects, and they do these annual reviews. But what about the multi-site studies? What about six-site, or as we recently had, 57-site studies of interventions blindly coded? The local IRB is only going to see its own site's adverse events or unanticipated problems. You need somebody who's going to be able to compare treatment A, treatment B, treatment C, et cetera, across sites, because they're going to see the problems first. They're going to find out that 11% of the subjects in treatment group A developed seizures or developed psychosis. They're going to see that before any local IRB is going to detect that, because the local site may only have six subjects in it. So that's the key reason why we have independent data and safety monitoring boards. They're the sort of early warning system for large-scale studies. Obviously, for a small pilot study, that's not so much of an issue. That's why, again, monitoring should be commensurate. Let's see. I'm just going to skip through that. As I mentioned, the key reporting requirement in the Common Rule is unanticipated problems. The definition of unanticipated problems is sometimes taken to be, if the risk is not in the consent document, then we'll assume that it was unanticipated. There's another reason to make sure that your consent documents accurately describe all the foreseeable risks, that you don't minimize them, because if something happens during the study and you didn't put it in the consent, people are going to say, well, then isn't that an unanticipated problem related to the study? And you're going to need to have a good answer to that question. So the fewer things you put in the consent, the more things you may be required subsequently to report to your IRB and potentially to us. Unfortunately, this is another little unpleasant secret of the government, the FDA and the NIH criteria for reporting are different. There is a document that came out from OHRP recently describing the differences, but it's a bit confusing. There are different systems designed to answer different kinds of questions, and there will be attempts to, as we say, harmonize the unexpected serious adverse events versus the unanticipated problems involving risk to subjects or others. You may have the same event, you may be required to report it to two different groups based on two different criteria. I hope I'll be able to come back here in the future and tell you that's not the case, but don't hold your breath. Yeah, given sufficient time, which we don't have, I was going to just describe some of the issues that come up, but maybe in a future talk. What you're going to hear in the future, there are revisions to the Common Rule and particularly the regulations involving research on children and adolescents that are currently being considered by the Secretary's Advisory Committee on Human Research Protections. You may have heard of NBAC, the National Bioethics Advisory Committee, and then the NERPAC. The current version we have is SACHARP, the Secretary's Advisory Committee. The previous ones have been allowed to die, to sunset. And SACHARP is the one that is currently operating. They have actually a very good committee. Susan Kornetsky and Celia Fisher, who some of you probably know, have been involved working with that committee to try and re-examine some of the regulations for research involving children and to make recommendations to HHS. Those recommendations are currently under consideration by HHS, and there's nothing final yet on that. We have heard that we may be seeing a special subpart for the decisionally impaired, maybe a subpart F or a subpart G, depending on what letter we're up to by that time. Children's regs are subpart D, so they're of particular interest to you. My concern is that the regs for people with decisional impairments due to mental disorders may actually closely resemble the regulations involving research on children. And as I mentioned earlier, because of the direct benefit versus indirect benefit issues, I think that may be a problem. And finally, I hope we will have some clarification of data and safety monitoring policies, and the NIH has just announced the formation of a committee to look at that. And so I'm sorry for giving you all this information in such a short time. I'm glad that you have them in the handouts, or at least the summary of the outline, so you can certainly send me an email or ask me a question, and I will try and clarify it either in advance or as these things come up when you're writing your application or dealing with your IRB, when I'm sure these things will have your complete and total attention. So thank you very much. Let me take some questions. I have about 5 minutes. Is that right, Cheryl? Yes. There's a microphone in the back. I think if you keep talking and the microphone comes on. Or not. There is, unfortunately, of course, a slightly different NIH definition. NIH has its own definition of a phase three clinical trial. It's in the NIH guide. It's in the citation, I believe, I referenced. I think it's June 10th, 1998, may be the appropriate one. If not, the reference may be cited in that. But a phase three clinical trial is typically described as a study with several hundred participants designed to answer a fundamental question regarding standard of care. Typically, those studies are going to be multi-site, and they typically then would require data and safety monitoring. Some of these aspects about the assumption that it will affect clinical treatment, I think, are contained within the NIH guidelines, but perhaps not in the FDA. Harmonization is a word you will hear frequently used, but we have a ways to go in that. Yes.
I have two practical questions about DSMBs. First of all, at the application phase, people routinely budget for constituting a DSMB and compensating people for their time. So that they.
That's one of those it depends answers. At some universities, the research office or the dean who handles research activities may have a system set up so that anybody who's doing a clinical trial, especially if you do a lot of clinical trials in the university, there may be a standing DSMB that can review a study if the scientific issues and the human subject protection issues are similar. For instance, the NIMH created an institute-wide DSMB now, because we're up to monitoring about 25 or so studies that Pam Schell and Christine Moretto review routinely. We now have three NIMH DSMBs, but you know, we have about 8 studies per DSMB. We simply couldn't constitute a new DSMB for each of these studies, and in most cases it would not be necessary. So, I mean, the more you make it clear that the people who are on the board are being paid by the university, the less independent they're going to look. But on the other hand, it is somewhat unrealistic to think that you're going to get 5 people who are going to volunteer from the outside to spend, you know, numerous hours reviewing data. It's typical in average circumstances to have somebody who may be at the same institution, but perhaps not in the same department. Maybe somebody in the medicine department or the statistics department somebody in a related department, so that they don't benefit one way or another from whether a particular grant gets funded or not. They don't get paid more or less depending on the grant, but they are right down the hall. Yes, please. You'd have a second half of that? You want to?
Yes, very quick. A rule of thumb for how often you want to see a DSMB, you know, when they're after 10% of the subject, after 25%. Give us some guidance about what's an appropriate interval.
Unfortunately, that's another, it depends. Depending on the risk and the rate at which unanticipated problems or adverse events are coming in, obviously the greater the risk, the more often the board is going to meet. The more subjects are in a study, the more sites are involved, the more often you're probably going to meet. Our DSMB has initially met quarterly, either by conference call or in person. We've now gone to 3 times a year. Some DSMBs may meet twice a year. I think once a year is pretty much an absolute minimum, since the IRBs have to review the data at that frequency. So if the DSMBs are doing something more thorough, you'd expect that they'd be doing this at least once a year. Yes, I'm sorry, Ray.
I just wanted to clarify that if I am doing an analysis or proposing a study that is not an intervention, that it does not require a data safety and monitoring board. Do I understand that correctly?
That's correct, and more, actually. If you are proposing a study that is focused on pathophysiology or genes predicting a particular disorder, if it doesn't involve an intervention, preventive intervention or treatment, it does not require even a data and safety monitoring plan. So not only do you not need a board, but you don't even need to tell them how you're going to monitor the data. Now, obviously, you're going to tell them how you're going to protect the participants from research-related risks. But the idea that you need to, for instance, compare adverse events in the group receiving drug A with those receiving drug B or psychotherapy C, and that's the reason that you have a data and safety monitoring plan, to make sure that people in one group are not being exposed to inappropriate risk. If you don't have that design, then you don't technically need that approach. Hold on. One more question. Go ahead.
Ben Vivor, University of Chicago. I had a quick question. Will you just comment on control groups? I think this is a nettlesome issue, particularly with children. Mm-hmm. You know, standard of care controls, usual care, a no treatment control. And then when you're testing, for instance, if you understand it's testing health services interventions, which may be lower cost versions of interventions that have already demonstrated efficacy, you're very concerned that your control not have unanticipated benefits that might wash out and not unable to see a potentially modest benefit size from a low-intensity intervention. But it seems IRBs are becoming very conscious of children not being deprived of standard of care, so you have this odd situation where they say, you would like to do this low-intensity intervention in a community setting, but you actually should refer all these children to a child psychiatrist, even though for the level of severity of illness and the setting that they're in, that's very unlikely that would ever be the treatment they would receive.
Right. This is the almost inevitable tension that IRBs are going to address when the issue is, well, is a placebo needed for this study? Is treatment as usual? You know, what that child would receive in the community if the child were not in this study or receiving this particular experimental intervention. You know, there has been more of a trend towards using treatment as usual, depending on the severity of the illness and the consequences of not treating, that consequences of using a placebo. And as you, I think you were suggesting, the IRBs are more comfortable with things like enhanced treatment as usual, or making sure that the treatment as usual is maybe not as usual, maybe better than usual, because if you're going to be in a research study, they would like to feel that you're getting something better than you would have otherwise. And so in their STEP study, for instance, there was a menu of reasonable care in a naturalistic phase. So there were standards for what, you know, people should be getting at a minimum. Unfortunately, as I think you're also suggesting, the more you throw in to enhance your control condition, the more difficult it is to show that your experimental intervention is actually better. And so if you enhance the comparator so much, you may not be able to find a difference, even if your experimental treatment is actually quite good. So you want to make sure that your study, that the design does not make it impossible for you to see the difference. But on the other hand, you don't want to make the control condition so bad that you're guaranteeing that you'll see a difference and that you're exposing kids to a risk that the IRB and we would potentially consider unacceptable. This is a very, very difficult question, and you're going to hear a lot more about it. Let me just make one plea for those of you who are going to write your grant applications. For your good and my good over the next few years, please never use the words passive consent in a grant application, okay? I'll give you some other suggestions as to how you can describe a process, but please don't ever use the word passive consent in a grant application. Because you'll have problems and I'll have problems and we'll solve the problems, but you'd be much better off describing things like a consent waiver and an opt-out provision or something along those lines. Okay? That's my secret advice for the day. Thanks.
Thank you.